Okay, so let me start by talking a little bit about my title slide, which serves the purpose of both identifying me and where I'm from and the other people to blame for what comes next. But also, I want to talk a little about why is a title like this in a conference like this? So let's kind of look about why is it that we're talking about these topics in a supernova gamma ray burst connection setting. So I would contend, sort of on agreement with Sri, that the reason asymmetric supernovae show up in a supernova gamma ray burst connection conference is simply because of the word asymmetric. And what I will also side with is that just because we have an asymmetry doesn't mean we have a jet. And so I'm going to be talking a little bit more about that. But I would argue that the nucleosynthesis part in here is aiming at the remnants part of this conference. So we're basically saying, how is it that we can start to take what's coming out of these asymmetric supernovae models, the nucleosynthesis we might predict from them, and match them up with some of the observations that are coming from remnants? That's the tie we're trying to make. So let me give you some history, because actually it's more for my edification, because it's not always clear to me how I ended up giving a talk about nucleosynthesis and asymmetric supernovae, when actually I mostly do kind of radiation transfer sort of stuff. So what I think happened is I was sitting in a room, and I said, hey, I've heard all this cool stuff that was going on about titanium and remnants and people saying that there's like mass cuts being probed by this kind of data. Shouldn't our stuff, our asymmetric supernovae that we've been working on, shouldn't it have some kind of ramification? And everybody in the room sort of took a step back, and I got volunteered to go and think about it. So here's some history. This is sort of the history that I had in mind from the point of view of someone who mostly spends time thinking about the explosion mechanism and the explosion itself. And I'm glossing over lots of details here. But essentially, titanium-44 was measured toward Cas-A, and it implied a very large ratio of titanium to nickel. And this was compared to spherical model predictions. So the idea was, some papers were written that the explosion asymmetry was possibly suggested as a way to make a higher titanium to nickel ratio, in the idea that titanium-44 is created in this alpha-rich freeze-out phase, which we've heard a little bit about, and that that's sensitive to the entropy of the explosion. I'm going to go into this in a lot more detail, but this is the level at which I knew it when I sort of decided that this would be a good project to work on. It was also suggested that ionization effects on the titanium of the lifetime of titanium could also help alter this titanium to nickel ratio. But a real key thing to keep in mind is that the solar calcium-44, which is the stable daughter product of titanium-44, and iron-56, the stable daughter product of nickel-56, the solar value of that is higher than what spherical models would predict. So right now we're kind of in a position where the spherical models that we've been predicting up until now with nucleosynthesis aren't matching any of the things that we can kind of see. We sort of think we have an idea of the titanium to nickel ratio in Cas-A. We think maybe we've got a handle on the supernova 1987A measurement, and we've got what solar is. And those are all kind of consistent, and the models aren't coming in. So, okay, so what's going on? Well, a lot of very good work has been done by Keiichi Maeda and Ken Nomoto discussing trends in a lot of different elements, but also in particular at some talks they've pointed out what is the alpha-rich freeze-out elements doing as a function of these hypernova explosions, looking at very energetic explosions, but still taking into account the asymmetries. And essentially, there's kind of two things that happen with the asymmetric explosions. You both synthesize the material differently, because a different explosion energy along one direction than another tends to synthesize material differently. But you also eject that material differently than spherical models. So the ultimate yield is affected by both these features. And so what I want to talk about is, what about more normal supernovae? So this has been highlighting some of the hypernova-type observations and trying to get at trends and alpha-rich freeze-out elements from hypernovae, and specifically is really making that branch of these asymmetric explosions tying to sort of gamma-ray burst hypernova, very energetic things. But what about the more normal supernovae that we've spent like the last, you know, many decades working on models for, and are we just going to throw those away? Is the supernova gamma-ray burst connection evidence so far along that we just say, oh, well, everything's got to be a jet? And I know we've heard a lot about why that's not true, but I just want to point out that there are jets, and then there are jets. Whoa, whoa, whoa. This is what I'm working on, and this I stole from Daniel Proga's webpage last night, just as a clear definition. The scale here is about 10 times less than the scale here, so you really should shrink that baby down, and then think of it in terms of the whole star. This is very, very collimated and has very high Lorentz factors. This has velocity symmetries of like 5-to-1, it's sort of puffy and nice and happy asymmetry. But the point is, this still has ramifications for the kinds of nucleosynthesis that are going to happen from what a spherical model would have given. But it's not this. It's this, not that. Okay. So that's when we're talking about the jet unification thing here. There's a lot of work that's been done on these asymmetries, but when we say asymmetry, and even, yes, I am to blame. I called this model one time Jet 2. What was I thinking? I should never have used Jet. But the point is, we do talk about this as being a jet. It looks kind of jettish. It's just nothing compared to this jet. Okay, so just keep that in mind. That's what we're talking about here. Okay, so that's what I mean about normal. I mean, not those big fancy jets that blow out of the star, really, really thin and really, really energetic Lorentz factor stuff. So this is actually a little bit more quantitative than just those two pictures. This is looking at the velocity profile of that Fryer and Hager one that I had on the left in the previous slide. So as a function of polar angle, this is what the velocity profile looks like. And I've got two fits to it. Essentially, the dots are the data points from an SPH calculation. The black line is a fairly smooth interpolation, sort of a cosine variation in angle of a velocity asymmetry, sort of a 2-to-1 asymmetry. And then this sort of top hat thing that I call here is basically if you really had a cone with hard edges, everything inside was high velocity, everything outside was low velocity. And it's somewhere in between those two. It's not really a collimated thing with a cocoon. It's something in between. It's a lot puffier. Okay, so that's kind of what I mean by normal. Now, the other thing that's come up at this is, okay, so we've been talking about alpha-rich freeze-out. The reason the mechanism people got into this game is because, hey, everyone's telling us we've got data now from the X-rays that's going to probe this region of the mass cut. It's getting down close to where your mechanism is happening. This is interesting to you. We can start to diagnose what's going on in this explosion. So the first thing that I ask myself is, what is the alpha-rich freeze-out? Because I didn't really know at the time, so I thought, okay. Well, there's this great paper by Tay et al. In 1998 that I think shows very well what is meant by the alpha-rich freeze-out. Okay, so let me start over here. What they were basically doing is saying titanium-44 seems to be important. Everybody's pretty interested in it. So let's do a study where we just take some parameterizations of an explosion. We make some assumptions about what the explosion is, basically something that gets shocked to a high temperature and then expands and cools. And we're going to parameterize that in some way, and then we're going to ask, what sort of nucleosynthesis happened for titanium-44 as a function of the peak density and the peak temperature that it achieved? So they get this sort of contour plot. And the first thing you can see is there's places that are very sensitive to details. So this essentially, it's hard to tell because they're so piled up on each other, but this surface sort of has a steep rise and then fall back down. This is a huge ridge peak that's going on right here, this ledge. And so essentially, the alpha-rich freeze-out is this region over here. And one way to do this is if you take one of these points and look at the time evolution of the abundances at this point. Mass fraction is a function of T9, which is the temperature in units of 10 to the 9 Kelvin. You can see that it's well named. The freeze-out for the alphas happens fairly early on, and as a result, they have stayed very high. So it is alpha-rich, and the freeze-out is the alpha-richness is coming because of the earliness of the freeze-out. Okay, now, I'd like to point out a further fact, which is that we had this discussion about what is meant by pure iron clump. Why would you think a pure iron clump would come from the alpha-rich freeze-out? Well, because if I weren't plotting log here, there would be nothing except for nickel-56, which eventually would decay to iron. This is basically 90% of the material created in this was created as nickel. This is like a dime compared to a dollar. I mean, we're talking change here in terms of what the helium comes at, and it's the next one that comes in. So the point is, that's why you've heard these types of things coming out in the remnant literature, that a pure iron clump would be indicative of something like an alpha-rich freeze-out. Though I will also show later on that if you just cross the alpha-rich freeze-out line and went over here, it turns out that it would also almost be pure iron. So, but this is the abundance pattern that we're thinking when we say alpha-rich freeze-out. Okay, so the question that I had then is, wow, alpha-rich freeze-out is supposed to probe this mechanism really well. So what I care about is, well, when is it done? So I'm thinking about, what is the time scale for getting the alpha-rich freeze-out done? So what is the time scale of my explosion mechanism? Do I really have to care? So alphas freeze out between 3 and 4. Titanium's freezing out between T9 of 2 and 3. So what does that mean in terms of time for these explosions? So that essentially means is this thing is peaking here at about time of 0.6 seconds, and between 2 and 3 happens somewhere over here. It's about a second. That's a time scale that's, for the mechanism people, that is still important. We're still making some contribution to the driving of the explosion within that second after you get shocked. For the stuff that's really close in, for the stuff, the Salford freeze-up that's really close in, that second, there's still mechanism things going on. It really seems to be the mechanism region which is setting the synthesis of these alpha-rich freeze-out elements. So what this means is, well, yes, we do have to care. But possibly it would be, we could do some upfront just thinking about the kinds of scenarios that we're going to be in and the kinds of changes we still expect to happen, given the uncertainties and the different kinds of ideas you heard earlier this morning about what is the mechanism, what kinds of changes are happening, what kinds of variation do we see when we incorporate different models, what if we include rotation. We've got a sense for what are the parameter space that affects the nucleosynthesis and how can what we finally agree on for the mechanism, how is it going to change within that parameter space? And is that important to the nucleosynthesis? And so the idea would be, well, let's come up with something simple at first to try and probe whether or not this is important for the nucleosynthesis, because it may be. Oh, sorry. Yeah, the black line is one trajectory. It's from a 1D model. And then this is basically two different fits. A power law fit of the expansion, so basically saying if I just pick a T0 and a Rho0 and I make some assumption about the way the thing expands, it's getting back at what are the different parameterizations that have been used by people in the one-zone model kind of community to parameterize what these are. Most people have used an exponential, which doesn't appear to be such a good fit. Power law is more what you would expect for density evolution, at least. I'm going to talk about that a little bit more, so let me just leave it there for now. Okay, so let's start, now that we're going to say this is important to us, and we actually have to get into the game and start maybe running some of these trajectories, let's make sure that the codes that we've got to do this are comparing well against what's been done in the past. So we have this great Tay et al. 1998 thing. Let's go take what we've got and actually rerun what they've got. And the dotted black lines are what was published in the literature by Tay et al. Before, sort of. I'll get to that in just a minute. And the colored lines are what the team that I've been working with for nucleosynthesis calculations found when they first tried to run this. And there's very different qualitative behavior. You see the ultimate freeze-out doesn't seem to be so sensitive, but there's very different qualitative behavior in the titanium as a function of time as you go through the evolution. And we kind of just went, oh no, this was definitely one of those what moments. And so we spent a lot of time contacting this group and finding out if maybe if they use new nuclear rates, what would they get? And actually, this plot is with the new nuclear rates. Everybody's using the same nuclear rates. So there were pretty significant differences. So we spent some time trying to understand, okay, what's going on? Well, let's look at the thing as a larger. There was another picture in that plot that gave a larger probe of parameter space. And it turns out if we try and match that, the contours don't line up one for one, but it's a similar shape. Good qualitative agreement. The issue is that this point, which was that standard baseline, is right on this ledge. And it turns out that's a place that's just, it's a very sensitive part of parameter space for these kinds of studies. And in this model, though, it's very difficult to see without overplotting and getting a really busy plot, that there's just mild differences in this ridge, and it makes it so that this point lies right on the other side. So we go from an alpha-rich freeze-out, which is what we saw in the baseline paper one, and then what we ran fell right on the other side of it, so it didn't give an alpha-rich freeze-out. Now, the upshot is, turns out that the titanium abundance across that ridge, as long as you're not in the ridge, on either side of the ridge, is roughly the same. You're not going to see big differences in what the ultimate freeze-out comes out to be. But this basically pointed us to, this kind of study is pointing us to exactly where in here we have these sensitivities, where we should start pushing the nucleosynthesis people to going. And looking at their rates and trying to understand where those sensitivities are. Okay, so generally speaking, we have pretty good agreement off that particular point, but that point has sent us on some nice investigations that I think will end up panning out to give us some good information on nucleosynthesis rates. But the ultimate goal of what I was trying to do with this, I said, okay, I want to know how this affects the mechanism. How is the mechanism going to change what these results are? So the idea was, how bad was the approximations that went into developing this? Because this clearly can give us some intuition for which regions of parameter space are sensitive. How bad were the assumptions that went into doing that? Were they fine? So one of the assumptions that went into that was that this is an adiabatic expansion, and that that means T cubed over rho equals constant. That was the assumption that was made. So if I plot the entropy of one of these trajectories versus time, and it's pretty consistent for a wide variety of trajectories, but I've just picked one out that's representative here. The entropy is a function of time. What I find is that the entropy being, you know, having it be adiabatic is not a bad approximation. But the problem is T cubed over rho, which is plotted in blue, is not necessarily a good characterization of the entropy being constant. There are other issues in the equation of state going on that affect that. So there's definitely something, I mean, there's clearly things that aren't 100% right about this, but, you know, let's see what kinds of differences they make. Well, first of all, let me talk a little bit. What about 1D versus 2D, okay? So if I plot 2D points here, unfortunately, we didn't run any things that had the 2D, a 2D progenitor and a 1D explosion of the same progenitor all in one. So we've got some 1D models that we use that are pretty typical that we tend to say things about core collapse. And then we've got one 2D model that was run, this Fryer and Hager model that I showed before. Essentially, this is a 14 Fo explosion. This is a 0.25 Fo explosion. The energy change in there is, you know, is something of order like 50. The velocity changes are square root of that. So we're looking at velocity of you know, factors of 10 velocity difference in here. If I were to take this 2D model, essentially what's happening in the 2D model, so we're plotting again the peak density, peak temperature. For all the fluid elements present in the supernova, we've got this spread of peak densities and peak temperatures. In a 2D model, because it's asymmetric along different directions, it kind of looks like a 1D model with an energy that's different from the other directions. So it basically takes one of these lines and it spreads it. And so what you're seeing is that a lot of the fact that this range doesn't fall over that is because the progenitor was different. We can slide that up and down by taking a different density profile of the progenitor. But the shift, this line, these two lines, kind of basically map out different levels of constant entropy, almost. You saw just a moment ago that that's not 100% right. But essentially, these are like looking at lines of constant entropy. And the range of entropy in here is roughly on par with the range in this 2D model, which had velocity asymmetry from a pole to equator of order 5. So we're seeing that an understanding of these 2D models by building up a series of sort of 1D explosion with different energies is not totally wrong. Okay, so what about, okay, so recall that when I showed you the temperature before, there were these two line fits on it. One I said was a power law, one I said was an exponential. Well, the power law seems to do a pretty good fit. So if the previous slide about entropy was right, that CQ to rho is really not a good approximation, then the rho that I derive from assuming T cubed over rho is constant will not be very well fit by a power law. And indeed, it kind of lies somewhere in the middle. For comparison, I put a 2D model trajectory on here as well. And so you can see this is what most people's intuition from their one-zone parameterizations has done in the past. This is what we would kind of expect from just understanding the dynamics of the explosion. And you can see for this 1D model, we kind of fit somewhere in between, and in these crucial first fractions of a second, we're maybe following the power law a little bit more. The 2D, though, never seems to show the steep fall off. It's just kind of a smooth, something that's maybe a little more fit by a power law. This was a different energy explosion, so hence the different time scale being longer. But the idea is that we've got this idea of power law versus exponential kind of bracketing some of the physics that we expect to happen. So how does the difference between that power law and exponential evolution affect basically what you happen? So if I look at sort of not an alpha-rich freeze-out portion and an alpha-rich freeze-out portion, the dashed lines are, I believe, the power law. And so the exponential. So the dark dashed lines show what an exponential model would have given you as far as evolution and what freeze-out would be. And in both a non-alpha-rich freeze-out and an alpha-rich freeze-out scenario. And there's differences of factors of a few, but certain elements it can make a big difference in. So it depends on how close we get to these sensitivity ledges. But the idea is that this isn't, we're not you know, revolutionizing the intuition that's come before just by going power law to exponential. So, okay, so let me just show right here, once again, recap. This is for the power law evolution. This is what the titanium 44 mass fraction, so you can see these regions of high sensitivity. This is what the nickel mass fraction looks like on one of these little contour templates. And you can see, even though alpha-rich freeze-out's cutting through right here, depending on which side you're on of it, still would get something that's sort of pure iron at the end. But titanium would stay pretty similar across that as well. Okay, so what would happen if I took one of those contour plots and I laid down the 2D points? I didn't put the 1D points on here, but they lie, you know, right along kind of the underside of it. What would happen if I laid those down and I said, okay, now I would like to say, it didn't look like these matches, these approximations were that bad. They bracketed the kinds of evolution that we expect to see. So, and the difference between the exponential and the power law, which seemed to bracket it, were only factors of a few different. So why can't I take something like this, lay these points down, and have this be just a template upon which I read off what the abundances are, so I don't need a nuclear network code. I can go back and try and get a back-of-the-envelope approximation of what kinds of things would I have synthesized. This would be tremendously useful. I mean, there's a lot of change going on in the mechanism right now, and it would be really nice to know, is there something simple that I can do when I've come up with a different set of parameters that's going to affect my explosion to say, did this new idea end up giving me 7 solar masses of titanium and there's no possible way in the world it could work? I mean, just something like that. We want something back of the envelope check. But we don't, I mean, it has to be somewhat close. It can't be, you know, we don't want to orders of magnitude off, but if factors of a few would be something that would still be useful, I think, for a lot of people working in the mechanism business. So what if I just take a bunch of these points and I lay them down and I add up the mass fractions and I plot them versus peak density? What is the mass fraction as a function of the peak density it inferred? And I do the models that came out. So this is a set of 1D models that Patrick Young ran for me. The models of actually post-processing the data, post-processing all these trajectories. And then what would laying those points down on the contour where an exponential trajectory had been assumed and laying the points down on one of those contour plots where a power law had been assumed? How close would I get? You can see the dashed lines are power law, the dotted lines are exponential, and the solid lines are models. And this is for titanium, this is for helium, and this is for nickel 56. And we can already start to see some trends that are maybe pretty interesting. The helium seems to follow more along with a power law sort of with a power law sort of distribution okay, I'm losing my thought process here. Essentially, factors of a few are what we're seeing differences here. And that's something that can give us pretty good information. On the larger scheme of things, the variations we saw in the abundance abundance patterns, this is the same scale as you saw before. The variations in the evolution as a function of those sensitivities of nuclear rates were huge. They were orders of magnitude difference, and we're getting things here that are kind of consistent to the order of factors of a few. And they're bracketed by the power law and the exponential assumption. So if we could just do better on that T cubed over rho, we might actually be able to do something that gets us really close to the answer. Now, the issue is this is just what got synthesized, and there's this whole other part, which is what actually gets mixed out, and how does that affect what the abundances are of what actually gets ejected from the star. And so there's a couple points I'd like to make here. What this essentially is looking as an XZ slice of, we took that 2D model that we had exploded self-consistently with the collapse and everything out to about 2 seconds. And then at 2 seconds, we mapped it into a 3D code and continued running it through the rest of the star. So sort of an under approximation to what the velocity asymmetry would have been, because at 2 seconds, we're still driving a little bit of that velocity asymmetry. So when we mapped it into 3D, we lost a lot of the convection engine that was going on underneath, and we stopped driving it. So we pretty much get that 2 to 5 to 1 asymmetry, and we're now running it through a 3D star. Essentially, this is at 2 different time slices where this is while the shock is still in the helium layer. And what you see is the colors represent where you started out initially in the progenitor star. So blue means you started out closer into the progenitor star. Red means you were further out in the progenitor star. And what you're seeing in this helium layer is that factor of 2-to-1 asymmetry is pretty much still retained as the shock went from 2 seconds where we saw 2-to-1 asymmetry, and we propagated all the way through to right pretty much inside of the helium layer. It's still sort of 2-to-1. And there doesn't seem to have been much of an inversion of the elements. There's still sort of stuff that was in the middle is still sort of in the middle of this explosion. However, once we send it through the hydrogen envelope where the density slope has gotten a bit shallower, and now we start to see Rayleigh-Taylor instabilities develop, we see a great deal of mixing, and going through the hydrogen envelope tends to spherize things. And so there's kind of a couple things. We retain, so if this had had no hydrogen envelope, something like maybe Cas A, we would have retained a sort of a 2-to-1 asymmetry. So one B's, one C's, Cas A kind of thing. We're looking at something here that is capable of giving us those factors of 2-to-1 and the density asymmetry that we need in order to match some of the polarization. So at that level, this kind of mechanism, which was not the jet stuff that we've heard a lot about, it was these very mild, much more mild asymmetries, seems capable of giving the polarization, at least for the type 1B, 1Cs. So without having to go to invoking a jet to be able to get these big asymmetries, we managed to get something that's still like that. When you add a hydrogen envelope, well, that's how you got your mixing. So there's kind of a weird thing going here. If you didn't have a hydrogen envelope, you didn't mix. If you did have a hydrogen envelope, you weren't aspherical at the end, so you don't match the polarization. But the issue is that this thing, even if we'd lost the hydrogen envelope, we should have some kind of wind material to go into. It would be R⁻², maybe, instead of R⁻⁠ of a typical hydrogen envelope. But the idea is we would still get some mixing going on here. And maybe not as avid as some of the mixing you see over here, but it might also retain some more of the asymmetry. This over here has already started to lose the amount that you've mixed. You don't see any preferential mixing along the axes. So let me conclude with just saying that these one-zone parameterizations provide a pretty good intuition for the nuclear burning that's going on, at least in the regions close down by the mechanism, which, as I said, that's what I came into this game trying to understand. How can what Cas A is telling us in X-rays come back and tell me something about the explosion mechanism that I want to know about? And I'm not sure. This has often been called the mass cut region, which when you move to multi-D becomes something that's not very well defined. So I prefer to call it the mechanism region. It's where you're still dealing with the mechanism. You're still deciding what's going to get the kick that gets out or stays in. The density asymmetry can persist in this model through the helium layer, but it's not clearly evident after the hydrogen layer, and there was no mixing until the shock enters the hydrogen layer. So there's some things that are complementary going on here from the point of view of 1B, 1C, remnant-y kind of stuff in terms of how do you mix it up. The 2D trajectories show differences in the density temperature evolutionists compared to the 1D models, and I apologize, I have a bunch of 2D trajectories that have been emailed to me pretty much today, but that was a little late from my collaborator, so that should be something that you should see later. And kind of lastly, I think the supernova gamma ray burst connection would benefit from a more accurate definition of jet. Just what do we mean, and when we're talking about a unified picture, are you guys really trying to tell me if that's true? That means all of my supernovae have to have a jet that's factors of 100-to-1 asymmetry in the velocity and Lorentz factors of huge. So I'll finish there. Thanks.
Thank you. Questions?
Now, I noticed that you have some rather low velocities in the equatorial direction. Now, what do you think could be the lowest velocity in the equatorial direction in the oxygen in the silicon layer, and you're still having a successful explosion?
The lowest velocity in the equatorial direction to still have a successful explosion?
Yes.
I don't have a good sense for that. I know, certainly, okay, so part of my confusion is this model is pretty different than some of the stuff that I did for my thesis, which was taking and saying, okay, we expect any velocity asymmetry imprinted at the beginning, you know, in the first couple seconds coming out of a core collapse simulation, we expect it to be retained until it hits the helium envelope. So essentially what we did is we said, well, let's take something that's already been exploded and done spherically symmetric synthesis and start blowing it up at like 100 seconds, which was right about when the shock was about to hit the hydrogen envelope. And depending on the velocity, the angular parameter, the angular variation of velocity, if it was top hat or versus the smooth, we got a very different behavior of the explosion along the pole. And if you were in a sort of a energy conserving way, if you wanted the total energy to be sort of the same, you got very low energies along the axis. I mean, you were looking down at effective, you know, fractions of a foe. It was very small along the axis, while you had something fairly large along the poles. And the issue to me with that is that didn't really borne out here. This was, even though we had started with something that was sort of 2-to-1 and kind of hard edges, you know, kind of top hat edges, it spherized a bit more and became sort of 2-to-1 you know, very, very smooth angular variation by the time it hit the hydrogen envelope. So.
Right. Okay. So the reason why I specifically ask is because in the black hole binary Nova Scorpii, we know that the companion star accreted quite a bit of supernova material. And that's very puzzling unless the velocity of the material is really low, and low, I mean, is about 1,000 kilometers per second.
Oh, yeah, definitely. There's, I mean, there's
but
material in here that...
Even the oxygen layer.
Yeah, we have fallback out to, like, I mean, this thing ended up being 2.6 solar mass remnant, and, you know, a lot of stuff from the inside got out, so a lot of stuff from the oxygen had to be close to that fallback area in order to still give us that remnant, so that shouldn't be too hard, but I'd have details.
Yes. It might be a good constraint,
yeah.
Actually.
Yeah.
Towards the beginning, I thought you said you were interested in in trying to explain the apparent high titanium to nickel ratio seen in Cas A. I wasn't clear whether that.
Yeah. So
you've understood that better now or not?
Yeah. Yeah. Sorry. So, essentially, if you look at what's happening in these plots are essentially what's giving me all the intuition at the moment. So the validity of these plots, I think, is what I harped on a little bit, but definitely still trying to understand what we get from these plots is good. If you were to take, so think about you have some spherical progenitor, right? So you've got this density, it goes as a function of radius, and now you drive an asymmetric shock through it. In the strong shock limit, which assuming that both the equator and the pole are in the strong shock limit, you're going to jump the density at those radii to the same density that, you know, both of them will achieve the same density, and the difference in the explosion energy along the two directions will show up in a temperature type way. So if you pick just a constant density and you move across into higher temperatures, essentially what you're seeing is you're seeing that you make more titanium for a higher energy explosion because they both have the same density, but they've come across with, they cut across these contours, and this is going to higher titanium 44. So you make more titanium 44 in a higher entropy explosion if you're in the alpha rich freeze out. Also, if you're not in the alpha rich freeze out, you're making higher amounts of titanium. So now over here, what you see is if you did the same thing for the nickel, as you cut across this way, you're cutting across, you're basically going to lower nickel as you go to higher entropy in an alpha rich freeze out. So yeah, the titanium to nickel ratio is going to go up faster than either one change independently, because when you put them together. So if you actually look at the plot, and I do have it, but I didn't show it, the contours here are a very steep increase in the titanium to nickel ratio. And on this side over here, essentially you see that the nickel's going up, but it turns out that I think, in fact, it's going up faster than the titanium in these regions over here. So you can actually find regions where the titanium to nickel ratio drops. Not necessarily the alpha rich freeze-out regions, but in the regions that still are producing some of the, they're producing mass fractions of titanium that are important, and certainly the set of points I showed goes across that region. So there are going to be parts of your problem where you can get, with increased energy of explosion, you could get a lower titanium to nickel mass fraction for certain regions. It's just more likely that the majority of your stuff is being formed in here. So that's why you see that kind of trend. Thank you, Roger, for bringing that up.
So my question is it what is more important, a higher energy or more asymmetry, or are they sort of equivalent? You know, you can get the same stuff by just having an overall higher energy without asymmetry, or having the same energy but having asymmetry. Is there any difference there?
Well, so that kind of comes down to, okay, how did you synthesize it, and then how did it get out? So that comes down to sort of this last plot here of, okay, assuming that it didn't start to overturn until later, until it hit the hydrogen shell, and by this time, you know, all the burning's done, then you basically burned it according to some asymmetry. So yeah, the asymmetry probably boosted the titanium and nickel fraction along one direction. And then it's a question of, did you preferentially eject that direction? And if your asymmetry were bigger, so this is what Keiichi Maeda has shown, if your asymmetry is bigger, you have the stuff blow out the top and it sort of curves around, and you do get this really serious inversion along the poles, and you see more stuff escaping. It's not clear to me what's happening here, because there is a lot of mixing up. And unfortunately, since I don't have the 2D data reduced yet. I can't just follow this back and take this picture, right? This is what you would want to do. You want to take this picture, and you want to go through, and you want to mark all the points that got out and take off the ones that didn't. And you want to find out which ones were important, and then look at where did they come out in the end spatially. So it's maybe
not the synthesis that is really that different, but it's more that maybe the fallback is different in the two models?
The synthesis is definitely different. At the moment, I can't tell if the fallback doesn't look asymmetric to me, so I wouldn't have expected that I ejected the stuff along the pole more. Because certainly stuff from the middle seems to get out as far along the pole as it did along the equator. So that's my current gut feeling, is that the synthesis must be driving it. But quite honestly, the synthesis, I mean, you get factors of a few enhancement in the titanium to nickel ratio, but then you still are playing the game of, you know, trying to use dust obscuration and stuff, because factors of a few doesn't get you completely there for the titanium nickel mismatch problem in CASE. Okay.
So. But going away from CASE and looking at the solar abundances.
Yeah.
So what would you say? You need more supernovae with higher energies, or more supernovae with asymmetries?
I would say you need the asymmetries.
The asymmetries.
Yeah. I mean, okay. I think it's got to end up coming out as the ejection thing, because I just don't think that the synthesis doesn't seem to be as big enough a deal.
Okay.
So it's almost got, there's got to be something about the preferential ejection. And we're not seeing it in our model. And so, again, that's the whole point of this, right? We, from the mechanism point of view, are trying to exhaust everything we can with asymmetries that can be achieved with the neutrino-driven mechanism. And if we, you know, it looks like we can probably get some of these. Certainly some of the other studies I've done showed more asymmetry. And this was a lower limit of the asymmetry that we would expect, because we stopped driving the explosion when we mapped it into 3D at 2 seconds. And there still should have been a contribution. So I would expect it to be closer to what Keiichi has found in some of his work, but certainly from what we've done here, I can't be definitive about that.
Okay, thanks.
I'm wondering about the mixing. Can you show the last picture again, where you have the mixing? I don't know whether I missed something or not, but it looked to me as if in the pictures which Thomas showed earlier, the mixing was significantly stronger. He had mixing between the oxygen and the helium. Why does it look so different? Is it different, or is it not different? And if it's different, then why is it different?
Okay, so maybe Thomas and I can have a conversation here. Certainly, the stuff that was here in blue started out inside of like 10 to the 9 centimeters. It's pretty inner stuff. It's like inside of 1.9 solar masses, enclosed mass. So it's mixing out pretty far. There are,
but you seem to imply that
there are 10, there's supposed to be 10 different colors on this plot.
You seem to imply that if you had no hydrogen envelope, you wouldn't get any mixing.
Yes. Now, that's except for the fact that when you would plow into the wind medium surrounding you, you would start to see some mixing from that as well.
But that's not the effects which cause the mixing in Thomas' simulations, I believe. So I'm really confused.
Did you see the mixing start to pop up very early on in the simulation, or just when it hit the hydrogen? It started early on. You saw mixing starting early on. So you saw a significant mixing even going into the helium shell. We get very avid mixing, but it doesn't start getting imprinted until we hit into the hydrogen layer. It's not until the shock goes. I mean, a lot of this I would almost chalk up to some sort of progenitor thing, because essentially what we can see is what's going on in ours. So if you look at the progenitor density, we have the slope of, you know, the rho goes like r to the minus 3 or greater up until about the hydrogen level, when it starts to plateau out to something less than minus 3. So you would expect to be accelerating, your shock to be accelerating down that density gradient until you reach that the hydrogen shell, and then the deceleration is where you would start to get the Rayleigh-Taylor instabilities to develop. So what we're seeing sort of makes sense to me given the progenitor that we're using, but that's not to say that Thomas and I aren't using different. This one was Alex's E15b. Yeah, 15 solar masses. But with some rotation, I mean, he had done something for rotation in there as well throughout the so that may be it. But I mean, that's the game that you're playing when you're looking at the mixing instabilities, is you're trying to see what is the slope of the density and how, when does the shock start to decelerate, because it's the deceleration of the shock that imprints these in the Rayleigh-Taylor instabilities.
Just a simple question. Is there still important uncertainties in reaction rate, nuclear reaction rate to...
Well, okay, so this is actually something that I think so the question was, is the uncertainty that came about from seeing that mismatch in that particular plot from the Tay et al. Paper, is that a meaningful difference still? And certainly Frank Timmies and Brad Meyer and Leeson Tay are still trying to track down what it is that's different. Maybe from outside of the community, I look at that and I go, wow, that's a steep ledge. There's a lot of uncertainties there. I'm not sure how much I would trust a numerical technique, but Frank at least tells me that it's premature to chalk it up to numerical issues, and probably there is still something going on in one of the rates. I know that Patrick ran for me something where he took that particular trajectory and he just perturbed the temperature by 1% and it flipped him over to the other side and he got a lot more consistent results with what Tay et al. Had before. So it's very small differences in the physical parameters which are making that huge change in what the ultimate trajectory looked like. The one thing that that is interesting is that the Tay plot with revised rates in that region got a factor of 10 less titanium mass fraction than what he had gotten from his 1998 paper. So something about the rates changed factors of 10 in that particular region in the titanium abundance.
Okay, thank you. Let's thank Amy again.